and welcome to Tiny Voice Talks with me, Tori Bono. And I am delighted that Pi Corbett has come back on the Tiny Voice Talks to tell me all about Walk for Reading. So welcome back, Pi.
Thank you very much. Yeah, always good to have a chin wag with you, which we've had over the years, a bit of a catch up and to share some thoughts about, usually it's been writing, but we've moved into, well, I've always done bits on reading, actually, going back a very, very long way. But everybody knows me, I think, a bit more for the writing.
Mm. Absolutely. And you said chin wags. I love them because I walk away slightly more knowledgeable. And I have learned so much about writing over the years from you. So I'm really excited about learning about reading from you this time. So Talk for Reading has just come out.
Mm-hmm.
Where has it been born from? I mean, I know you've always been doing things, but tell me about it.
Yeah, I've always done reading, you know, has always been a big thing, obviously, because the reading influences the writing. But this in particular started, and I really thought we need to put an emphasis on this, in 2016, because if you remember, that was the year when the SATs changed and the reading got harder. And what happened across the country was fascinating because we had schools here in Gloucestershire who were sort of typically 95% level four and above. And then suddenly they were 38% level four and above. So there were real changes because the test had got harder. And the expectation was much higher. So the other thing that occurred was some of the Talk for Writing training centres and other schools that I know around the country either stayed the same or even went up. So I thought to myself, well, you know what I'm like. I always like to, you know, part of my role in life is to help teachers and schools grow and develop. And I thought, well, we ought to really look now seriously at what is it that effective schools are doing. So we worked with a number of our training centres and we started with a review. So Dean Thompson, who's one of the trainers I work with, Dean used to run the school improvement service across the country under the national strategy. So Dean knows a lot about school improvement. And he's a great trainer and good fun to be with, etc. So anyway, Dean and I began a review. So we visited schools where the teaching of reading was leading to high standards. And I spoke to on the phone to various head teachers in the same position, like the head of Parklands in Leeds.
Chris Dyson.
Yeah, Chris. So I spoke to people like Chris, Simon Kidwell, you know, people who Simon Smith, a lot of people will know. And I put together, we began to develop a sense of what we were looking for is, are there common features? So effective schools in reading, are there common features in what they're doing? Can we work that out and then articulate that and share that? So we started with a review, we worked something out, and then we began to work with a larger group. And that then led into various two-year projects. So it's taken 6 years to get to a stage where I felt sufficiently confident to say, actually, this works. You're going to raise your standards if you do this and have more kids who go on as happy readers. So that's the background to it.
So I'm guessing then, if, you know, it's taken six years and you've done your review, etc., and then you moved into a large group, I'm guessing that you did identify common features that if, you know, if we're to improve children's reading, that's what we should be doing.
Yes. At first it was very difficult because it looked as if everybody was doing different things. And that's partly why it took so long. It's like Talk for Writing. I don't think... When did I first bring a book out on Talk for Writing? It was a very long time. Been something like 15 years. Maybe 12 years, something like that, before Julia and I did a book. And the reason for that is I really think it's incorrect if people publish things on the back of just research. without double checking that what you're talking about, the researcher may say that, but, you know, I've been in education 40 years and I've seen research say one thing and then another. It's a bit like that thing, are you allowed to drink a glass of wine? And some research says yes and some says no. And in the end, you think, oh, well. And certainly in education, you know, we've been batted around as a profession by various bits of so-called research. And for me, what matters most is, does it work in a range of schools? So have we got, if you like, transferable approaches that different schools can take on, maybe adapt a bit to meet the needs, the specific needs of their children? Because if you think about it, if you're working in a very poor, challenging area, children are going to need more work on talk and and a lot of practice at reading, because they're not going to get it at home. If you're working in a school fairly near where I am in Gloucestershire, there are schools where there's one school I can think of where my wife worked, where there are only two children on free school meals. That means you've got more, generally speaking, it means you've got more literate, articulate kids who've got books at home and every advantage in life. So the weighting, if you like, the amount of effort you have to put into certain things changes. But nonetheless, there are common practices in reading that apply across the board that we know now are very, very helpful. So the book is based really on what works. And obviously what works, you often find, is reflected in some bits of research.
And I think you're absolutely spot on when you say about the research. I remember someone once saying, if you want, you know, if you want to find research for something to back something you think up, you will find it. It's out there. You've just got to search long enough. I think you're absolutely spot on about that. Now, I'm interested in the work talk with reading, because we've talked a great deal about talk and the importance of talk to get children writing. You know, they can't write it if they can't talk it.
Yeah.
Where does talk then come into reading in it, you know, for you?
Well, perhaps if I'll set out the first three big things for you. So,
oh, nice. Yeah.
Yeah. It's in the book. It's a bit like one of those Russian dolls. We try and give the big picture and then break it down and down and down to the nitty gritty, if you see what I mean. So you get an overview first.
Yeah.
So the first thing is, there are three big aspects that a successful school has to develop. And the first one is one everyone will recognize, but not everyone does, which is have a fabulous reading culture. And there has been, as you know, you'll be very aware that there's a lot. Well, the Open University Reading for Pleasure movement, and anyone listening to this, you know, just log that into Google. They do a free newsletter, and around the country there are enthusiastic groups of teachers who meet at the end of the day just to share books, just to talk about books.
Yeah.
And so you have to have a good reading culture. So the schools that are successful, when you go there, you know it's a reading school because that enthusiasm and passion for great literature in its broadest sense of poetry, nonfiction, and fiction. You meet passionate people, enthusiastic teachers. You can see that they're well-resourced. They give time to it. So they have a very strong reading culture. And one of the things about that is, quite simply, the children are motivated. They love reading. They're read to very often. They know about authors. They have, you know, all the usual things like book, well, I say usual, things like book weeks, etc. So they're totally up for it. And that's motivation. And in fact, any subject, you need motivation. If people aren't motivated, they're not inclined to learn. So a great reading culture is important. It sounds a bit soft, but it's not. It's totally necessary. So we know a good, great reading culture is going to be important. So a lot of schools are into that. The second thing you have to have is a highly effective way of teaching phonics. So that's your basics bit. And phonic programs, even if the government have said this one's, you know, they have a list, don't they, of ones that you're allowed to follow. And even with that list, I would say that some things are more effective than others. some things in the long run are more costly than others. Some programs eat into a huge amount of curriculum time and aren't necessarily any more effective than other programs where you might only be doing 25 minutes a day in early years. So the program that we recommend is called Sounds Right. And what I love about Sounds Right is that it's basically 4 days training. It's pitched high mm-hmm. in as far as you are expected to, do some background reading, etc. So it's not patronizing. It's pitched high, and it's based on very sound principles of how children learn, and also very sound principles of the background into phonics and what we know from what happens in the brain. Sounds Right is very focused on pure teaching of phonics. No messing around with anything other than teaching phonics. And in the hands of a good teacher, your 4 days training, I see it on Twitter all the time. People saying this has revolutionized that. We can see the effect already. Yeah. So if anyone's sort of wavering on the whole business of phonics, don't waver anymore. Sounds Right works. And it because it's sound to print, it's great for spelling and get some writing. And it's great for decoding. So you've got three things, I said. So the first one is reading culture. The second one is highly effective mm-hmm. teaching of phonics. And the third one is comprehension. Mm-hmm. And talk for reading, yes. Obviously, we talk about all three things. But our main focus is on developing comprehension, which is vocabulary as well as sort of deeper understanding. So that's the big overview. Now, did that make sense?
Mm-hmm. It made complete sense, actually. And I think, yeah, you're spot on with everything. And I've got to say, you know, when you mentioned the OU and the teachers' reading groups, they are so, so wonderful. And they really do help a school to establish that reading culture that you're talking about. I think, you know, so much can be said for them. So, yes. So
you meet nice people at these things, Tori, because they love their reading and they're giving up at the end of the day to go along when they're exhausted with all the problems that we got in education. And they go along to, you know, some school and they all get together. And these are good, good people. And certainly if you were an NQT or whatever, you know, go along to one of these. You're going to make friends with nice people who teach locally and who love their, of course, they're nice. They like books.
I think that's the thing. And I think to any teacher listening that's going, oh, my goodness, that's another afternoon after school. Actually, what I've found again and again from the teacher reading groups, and also I have done a podcast with Teresa Kremen and her various the people that work with her, including Sonia. And actually, it's well worth listening to that. There is so much to get out of those teacher reading groups. Mm. And I know that every afternoon that I would leave it, I would just have left with a little bit more in my sort of knowledge bank for what I wanted to do next with reading. So, yes. So, Pike, so we were on comprehension. Those are the three main things.
Yeah, those three things. What we found was that schools that were highly successful and have standards in reading that were surprisingly above what you would expect given the area that you're in, those schools paid equal attention to all three things, both as a school and in classes. So one of the problems, I think, and challenges for early years is because there's so much attention, and year one and year two, there's so much attention on phonics. If you're not careful, you don't give similar attention to comprehension and reading for pleasure. And you can understand why it gets out of kilter. So what we realized in the end that if you think of it as a Venn diagram with three circles, maximum impact is when you get all three things absolutely on it and driven by the senior leadership team. That was another big thing, was that the leaders were totally passionate about this. They knew that, particularly in poor areas, that if their kids leave and can't read and go to secondary school unable to read well, that that's setting those children up probably for not getting a GCSE in many subjects, etc. So the leaders they knew exactly what was going on with reading across their school. They knew the reading program. They drove the reading program. And as you know, you can't really get anything done if the senior leaders, well, there are a lot of people who say, oh, yes, we believe in this, but aren't focused enough. Or to put it more positively, these leaders were absolutely focused on this. So that's a bit about the leadership. And then we go into the whole process of what we do. I'll go through the process for you. So not surprisingly, you know, I like three I's. Imitate, innovate, independently apply,
indeed,
invent, etc. So I rather naffly started with that. We changed course as we went along, but we did end up with introduction, investigation, and independent application. So I'll take you through it. So the first thing to do is to think about across the year, we need a balance in terms of teaching comprehension, in terms of some poetry, some fiction, and some non-fiction. So you've got to map out your blocks. And it's not a bad idea, of course, to match what you're doing in writing with what you're doing in reading. That makes good sense. Or indeed make links into the rest of the curriculum. So the thing has to cohere a bit. So the next big thing is it's important to have high quality, challenging texts that are above where the children are. In other words, nobody in the room could read this at the moment. It's going to need us to read strategically. And that's quite important, that notion.
Okay.
If the text isn't challenging, if it's too low weight, then no one's going to learn anything. We won't need to read strategically, so we won't learn much about being a reader. So it has to be challenging and carefully chosen, because not every text lends itself, for instance, to thinking about characterization or thinking about viewpoint. So high quality, challenging text that we're going to spend some time with. Now, actually, we used to do this, if you think back, when we had big books and things. You'd have a big book in, you know, year one or whatever, and you spend 4, 5, 6 days with it, and each day you'd reread it through, and you'd be digging deep and deeper as you go along. In essence, it's that idea. So we've chosen our high quality challenging text, and what we don't do is say, have a routine which says, well, on Monday we do inference, on Tuesday we do prediction, on Wednesday we do. So it's not driven by doing strategies. If you think about doing strategies, why do you use a strategy? You use a strategy to get at meaning, to understand something. So just chucking a strategy at it is sort of pretty pointless. So what we do is we are going to read strategically, because this is a difficult text. And in order to get meaning from it and understand it and enjoy it and appreciate it, we're going to have to read strategically. So there's a difference with reading strategies. We teach the children to read strategically. What I mean by that is a really effective reader, for instance, at Christmas time when you get the Radio Times, will know where to look in the Radio Times to see what films are happening on Christmas Day. And what you don't do is start on page one and flick through. So you'll know how to skim through, find the right section for the information. That is a very different strategy to the one that you might use with a cracking good novel that you're reading every night, if you see what I mean. So depending on the text and depending on our knowledge about what is in the text, we read things differently. And we need to help children. When I was an inspector, not that I ever enjoyed doing that, but when I was an inspector, this is a simple example. I used to take around with me a book about cities and big towns in England, and I'd just give it to a child, or, you know, when I heard them read in that bit, and I'd say, can you find me the bits on London? And then I'd wait and see. Well, you know, you'd expect a year four to instantly look for the, you know, if there are chapters, or go to the back and use the index to find the word London, flick through and find it. And some kids could and some kids couldn't. And of course, the ones who can't don't know how to read that sort of text strategically. So it's not about following a mechanistic routine where we do strategies. It is reading strategically is slightly different. So the three phases then, bearing all that in mind, the three phases are the first phase is, we call it introduction. This is very much, right, by the end of this phase, the children are going to be able to basically read this text and have a fairly basic understanding of it. So during that phase, you'd read it a number of times. They might well join in with reading it as you go along, if that's appropriate. You'll be doing a little bit of prediction probably at the beginning, because that's the only time you can do some prediction. But my experience is that most children are able to do prediction anyway, as long as they know something about life. You'd also have to work on vocabulary and thread that in, because if we don't know what the words mean, then we're never going to understand what's going on. So you'd have some basic vocabulary work just to check on that. So by the end of this first phase, the children, in essence, are able to pretty much read the text. Now, there might be a hook. There might be context setting. We might activate their prior knowledge. What do we know about this, etc.? And we'll be taking our initial responses and thoughts on this. What did we like about it? Anything we didn't like about it? What memories? Have you ever done anything like this? What surprised you most? So a bit of a chat around the whole thing. And then we move into the second phase. And the second phase is the investigation. Now we're going to dig deeper.
Can I just ask a question?
Yes, do.
So you said that it is a high quality, challenging text.
Yes.
So when it's introduced to the class, is it read by the teacher to the class initially, with echo reading going on, or do the children independently access it first off?
No, you read it to them, because they won't be able to read.
Thank you. That's Well, that's what I thought when you said that, but I just need to clarify it in my head.
Yeah, you know, do ask questions, because it's clear in my head, but but I've got to try and explain.
I think that makes sense, because I think what you're saying makes complete sense, and I found it refreshing what you said about the teaching children to read strategically rather than strategies, because I have seen over the last few years, more than anything, I've seen lessons where it's like, oh, we're going to do a lesson on prediction, we're going to do a lesson on inference, and it's like, actually, that's not what a strategic reader does. A strategic reader chooses the correct strategy for that moment, but knows how to dip in and out. Whereas if you're just teaching, this is the day we're doing this, they don't begin to recognize how to read strategically. So sorry, really refreshing that. On to investigation.
Yeah, you've absolutely got it. Now, of course, investigation is, now we're going to dig much deeper. Now, whilst we put it as three phases, digging deeper might well occur on day one, of course. In order to try and explain it, we've broken it into three phases, but in the classroom it doesn't necessarily happen like that. Just to go back to that thing, the teacher reads it to the children. By the end of the unit of work, the children would be able to read it to the teacher.
Yeah.
So it's that gradual movement.
Which makes complete sense, yeah.
Yeah, it's the same.
It's that ownership.
Yeah, it's the movement from dependence to independence. So at the beginning of the unit, you're dependent on the teacher reading it. By the end of it, you are master of that text. You can read it, you can discuss it, you understand it, you can compare it with other texts, you know about it, you know more. And actually, looking at those strategies, the main thing is, by the end of it, they will have had a deep, rich experience of a great text that will last them for a lifetime. That's the purpose of the strategies, etc. So we move into the investigation, and there are a number of things that are going to happen with this one. But basically, by the end of this, which, you know, it might be, I don't know, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 days, all depends on the text and the children, of course. But we're going to do some strategic reading. I'll give you an example. There's a film clip, because it comes with 21 film clips, the book. And there's a film clip there of Tracy from when she was year six teacher at St. Matthew's. And she's looking at the philosopher's views of heroism, the nature of heroism. And we got an introductory paragraph, and then we go, I can't quite remember, but let's say we go to John Dryden. We get a paragraph on John Dryden's views on heroism. So what Tracy does in the session is she shows them how to extract the two or three key points that John Dryden makes in that paragraph. Then the next paragraph is, I don't know, Nietzsche or whoever. So they then do that one together. And the next paragraph, the children do independently because they know how to read through the paragraph and how to work out the two or three key points. So that's quite a good example, really, of I'll show you, now we'll have a go together, now you have a go on your own. And you're being taught a really good strategy of pausing, slowing down, highlighting the key points, extracting those, get them onto a grid so you can compare what the different philosophers think. So we do some, there'll be strategic reading almost inevitably, plus a lot of what people call dialogic talk. You know, that whole thing of, it's the tell me Aidan Chambers thing of, okay, what did you notice in that? What two or three key things have interested you? So this is, it's actually, when you're doing strategic reading, the teacher is very much in charge and is very much the sort of center of it and is directly teaching. The dialogic is the other side of the coin, where this is about the children talking things through, noticing things, talking about their understanding with the teacher, orchestrating and challenging. So we got the dialogic chat. I used to call it, you know, let's have a talk about this. Then you got your response activities, which might be drama to experience the text more emotionally and more engagingly and help them imagine. So that might be art. It might be drama. It might be model making. It might be little ones be playing at the story. Then we got reading as a writer, which you'll know about. So that's where we think about what effect is being created and how did the author do that. And always, of course, at the end, before we move to independent work, summarizing. So what do we now know? What was this all about? And, of course, by the end of this phase, they should be able to read it fluently, which means they can read the text and they understand the text as well. So that's the second stage where you've got a number of different techniques: dialogic talk, strategic reading, response activities, reading as a writer, leading into summarizing.
The summarizing, I think, is so vital because that's an area that children really, really struggle with, actually summarizing what they've read. And often, I hate to talk about SATs, but often really struggle if they're asked to summarize in SATs. They really find it tricky because it's not something they're skilled in doing.
No, and the only answer is if they're not skilled in doing it, it's because we're not teaching it enough or we're not teaching it successfully. Yeah. So it always comes round to, and if you notice in your SATs analysis that the summary questions, you know, were poorly answered, then let's have a think, go right back to reception, year one, year two, and think about what sorts of techniques might we use to help children get more used to summarizing what a text was all about. So that's the second phase where we dig deep. And then the third phase is now, can they identify the key focus, demonstrate their understanding, and maybe even apply it into their writing? So if we've been working with a focus on characterization in year one, they should be able to, for instance, talk about books that have got contrasting characters, the goodies and the baddies. That's what they should have learned about character. So there is always a focus or several focuses depending on the text. And you've got that new bit that I talked about, which is the strategic reading, rather than we always bung five strategies at every text, whether or not they need them. So I think that when I alighted on that term strategic reading, for me, that was one of those light bulb moments. I thought, ah, right. If you put it that way around, it makes sense. The other big thing that's new is the literary concepts, because I think there is a difference between teaching children to read, which is obviously central to what we do, and then you've got the subject English. And if you look at English in secondary and up into higher education, I think there are core English concepts to do with reading. Mm. So the literary concepts, and I developed this a lot through conversation a lot with somebody called Bob Eagleston, who's professor at Royal Holloway. And Bob and I, he's married to my oldest daughter. So we've had a lot of conversations around what are you teaching in terms of reading and English at university? What are you actually teaching? You've got, obviously you're teaching the text, but are there underlying things? And over time, I got six different concepts out. So you might be teaching, the first one is structure. So you might be learning very much about how a text is structured and how that affects the purpose and the way in which you read it. So at the end of year six, children should know about text being structured and organized in different ways for different purposes. So that's a big one, structure of text. Yeah. The next one is the role of characters or issues or information. So the role of those things in different texts. Then you've got setting, which creates moods and atmospheres and tones. So obviously character and setting are very big things. Use of language, that's a big one, isn't it? So figurative language, for instance, in poetry and in narrative, and occasionally you get good use of metaphor in nonfiction, which can powerfully put across ideas. So you've got the use of language. And then the two others, main themes or arguments in nonfiction or ideas. And theme, of course, is a really big one for narrative. What is that story all about? You take something like The Three Pigs. Is it about pigs? And the answer, of course, is no, it's not. You know, is Billy Goat's Gruff really about goats? And the answer is no, because we could have had three sheep and it's still the same story. So what is it really about? What's going on? So digging deep into themes is important. And the final one is, I think, very interesting, which is to do with perspective and viewpoint. So in year six, we could have a bit of nonfiction or a bit of fiction. We could be thinking about the viewpoint of the writer and where's the evidence that suggests what the writer thinks, which might be different to the viewpoint of a narrator, which might be different to viewpoint of the characters, which might be different. Yeah. And finally, we could look at the reader. So you take something like Bill's New Frock. Do you know that one? When Bill wakes up and he's turned into a girl, a sort of metamorphosis story.
Yeah.
Well, the intriguing thing about that is girls may well read that, interpret it, and think about it differently to boys, because that's what it's all about. Yeah. And of course, if you were in, if you were doing in higher education, you might be doing, you know, the Marxist viewpoint on this particular text. But certainly in year six, you can get into good discussions about how different. Take an example of a description of a town in Suffolk was one I often use, and it's by the sea. And the activity is you split the class into three, so. Pretend that you're a family with little children. Read through the brochure about this seaside town. Would you go there on a holiday? And then you've got a group of people who are the old people living in the town. What's their viewpoint?
Mm.
And then you've got somebody who's a builder and fancies doing a housing estate. What's their viewpoint? And now I think about it, you could have people on the local council. And what's their viewpoint? So we're looking at viewpoint there, and I think there are I think all of that's important, because one of the big aims is to help children read critically. and you think about the way in which the media manipulates everything, you think about TV, the way that manipulates our thought, newspapers, anyone who's been in a newspaper knows that everybody reports it with a bias. So looking at viewpoint and bias are really important things. So those give us our focuses. And that's new thinking.
And I really like that. No, I think that's really important. And something I know that, as you know, I'm an ELE. And so I've been reading lots about the Education Endowment Fund and their various reports that come out. And one of the things that they've found that's really hitting secondary school students is this disciplinary literacy. In other words, they learn to read in a certain way at primary school, but as soon as they are having science texts or geographical texts or anything else, they're really struggling because actually they aren't used to that structure. They don't know how to deal with the language because the language is different. And actually, that whole thing that you've said about perspective, viewpoint, bias, absolutely vital when you're addressing sort of historical texts, for example.
Yes. I mean, it. One of the things that we talk about in the book is, and our schools do, is they teach reading in English, but also in other subjects. So the simple rule of thumb is this: what would happen if you said to your staff, "Okay, what we're going to do is every single day when you are doing another subject, just choose one." So it might sometimes be a historical bit of writing, or it might be geography, it might be science, it might be maths. But every single day, we're going to spend 10, 15 minutes in another subject, and you're going to get up on the screen. With little ones, it might be one or two sentences. With year six, it might be a paragraph. And we're going to read that paragraph through, and we're going to do a sort of mini talk for reading in 10, 15 minutes, where we read it through a number of times. And that gives you a chance for daily practice of skimming, scanning, bias, retrieving three basic facts, which are opinions, which are facts, how do you know, etc. And that simple idea of every day in every class across the curriculum, there's at least one session where they're going to do some quick reading. And, of course, the reading is in relation to what you're learning. So it strengthens the learning. It strengthens the understanding of the vocabulary and the sentence patterns that they're going to need. And it's more reading practice. And that's a really big one, a really big part of it. We put that in the reading culture bit to make sure you directly teach reading across the curriculum daily. And, of course, when you do that, you almost double your effect.
Absolutely. I think that's really important that actually reading doesn't just sit in the English classroom. Yep. It is something that is intrinsic to everything that we do.
Yeah. Now, the other thing that's linked to it is one of the other books, and you can get the Talk for Reading book on the Talk for Writing website, and it comes with a link to 21 different clips. Some of me larking around doing my best. And some of the teachers have been a bit more skillful because they're doing it all the time, but they're there for illustration. And I'm, you know, always grateful to teachers who say, well, yes, I'll have a go. You know, you've got to be brave to do that. But we've got people like Tracy from St. Matthew's, and wonderful. I mean, she has to be one of the best teachers in this country. She really, really is an inspiration. But the other book that's there, and it is a massive text. So it is like reading a telephone directory, and it's actually aimed more at secondary, but it's also got year five and six in as well. But it's called Transforming Learning. And what that looks at, you don't need the text really. You just need to, you know, people just need to be thinking about this. And I know some are. But we've been working again, this was over the last 5 or 6 years, on the whole business of each subject has its vocabulary and its sentence and text patterns. So part of being a scientist, if you went to Selby, which is one of our training centres in Yorkshire, south of York, very, very poor area, huge unemployment, etc. In year one, the kids learn, when they're doing science, they learn, we are investigating what happens when. We predict, that means we think, we think this because. So they learn scientific, not just the vocabulary, you know, words like, I don't know, condensation in year three or whatever. You've got to learn, you know, temperature, condensation. You've got to learn for each unit. There will be vocabulary. But also the sentence patterns that you need to talk and think like a scientist.
Yeah.
So some of our centres now, and eventually we'll be in a position to publish this, and I'm hoping that it will be useful to people. We're working out what would the – and maths has done a lot of this through the maths hubs and White Rose Maths and things. So thinking about, I don't know, in history, you've got the vocabulary from different units. It's not so much that. It's the transferable historical language you will always need. And can we work out a cumulative progression so that we start early on and they begin to acquire some of that language so that they can think and express themselves as geographers or historians. And it's a big thing to do, but we're in the middle of doing it and working with teachers and schools. And I think when we publish that, it'll be very useful. It won't be perfect. Nothing's perfect, but it'll get us all going and take a big step forwards.
I think it really will. I think, you know, actually what you're discussing, you know, that idea of a progression of language and subjects is absolutely vital, because I teach year four and I still have children that are not using that scientific language as just part of the science lesson. It's seen as, you know, something new and different as opposed to something they've built on over the years.
Yeah, if in year one. And I mean, Selby, a lot of those kids really have challenges, and it'll be even worse now because of what's happened. So these are not children who come from, you know, they come in and a lot of them have never been read to. You know the scenario, you've taught a lot. But that doesn't mean they can't learn. And, of course, the oral work, the talk, this is why it's taught for writing, taught for reading. It's the oral work that is going to absolutely liberate them as thinkers in the end, because you use language to talk your way to an understanding. So somebody can tell you something or show you something, but it's only when you yourself have articulated that thought and begun to add that thought into your schema, it's only then that you begin to have the chance that you might hold on to that thought and be able to manipulate it and use it, etc. So the talking our way, I suppose what we could say is, if reading lessons are silent, then they'll be practicing but not necessarily learning. And it's shifting away.
Yeah.
Certainly when I was at school, you got a page with a text, usually an extract, and then the opposite page, there were 10 questions. And, of course, the trouble with that, we've spoken about this before, I'm sure, the trouble with it is either you know the answer or you don't know the answer. So that just confirms that you're confirms you're useless and you can't.
And I think those lessons, you know, that I also you know, I remember reading in school was always a silent lesson. You sat down, you had your text, you would read the questions, you'd answer the questions, and you were fine if you could read capably. But if you couldn't, well, you didn't stand a chance because you couldn't read the text, you couldn't do the questions. And actually, I'm waffling on now, probably on a soapbox here.
That's right.
I even wonder if I actually learned anything from those lessons, because I was a capable reader, but no one taught me to read strategically as you are talking about.
Yeah, to read strategically and then develop a deep understanding of those core literary concepts which underpin being an effective, efficient reader who's highly knowledgeable about texts and can discuss somewhat airily in some year six classes the viewpoint of the narrator. It's exciting to hear children talking about the narrator having this viewpoint and here's my evidence. However, the characters, and different readers might, you know, you hear that going on, and you think, wow, this is really interesting. This is a whole new thing for us, and it's exciting.
It's really exciting, and it gives our young people such amazing opportunities moving into their future, really, and to think that actually we're able to really change the paths of so many children with regards to reading.
Yeah, and I'm just skimming through the book. We've got a bit on parental engagement in there, because we all know if we can get parents on side, that helps. And there are some reports back from our different training centres, mini case studies in there about what they've been doing. Some of them, I mean, Penwood, for instance, in Slough, 98% EAL, and a high percentage. On average, children only spend 2 years in Penwood. They come and they go like yo-yos. And anyway, our schools talk about what they have been doing with parents, which is interesting. There's a whole section on reading across the curriculum. But, of course, one of the big things is for all of us is vocabulary. And it sort of comes back to, because you can't comprehend if you don't know what the words mean. And phonics can help you read the words, sound, you know, say the words, pronounce the words. But, of course, it doesn't give you much else unless you recognize the words and can tie them together in the sentences. So you've got to work hard on the what they call the knowledge rich. You know, kids have got to know things because words are related to knowledge. They're inextricably linked. You don't know it until you've got the words and can manipulate it and talk about it. And that, I think we're missing a trick with the knowledge-rich curriculum. I'll just slip this very quickly in. When I taught in year six, the pinnacle of year six was for them to plan and do their own investigative project. And the way that can be done very badly, but the way I did it was they had to, first of all, produce a plan. And we spent probably spent a couple of weeks on developing and growing their plan. It had to have in sort of different chapter headings, where were your sources, who are you going to write to, which books were you going to look at. You've got 8 books here. Well, double check, because you want the most recent ones because they'll be up to date, all of that sort of thing. So, and then they'd spend most of that summer term, they wrote these amazing projects. And it was the end result of everything that we'd done was that they were able to take a topic they were interested in. Ralph did beekeeping, I remember. Hannah did a whole project in lighthouses. So take something you're interested in. And that's where they were able to enthusiastically, independently drive a project, an investigation on their own. And, of course, what happens is, depending a bit on the subject, but very often you're drawing on geography. So you look at the lighthouses. There's a lot going on there in terms of geography and history straight off the top of our heads. Oh, and then we got Grace Darling, so we got some literature creeping in. So it very much was an opportunity for, if you think about knowledge-rich curriculum, you get history, geography, science, etc. You get, and they're all separate. But really, if you look at our, you know, if you were going to do some work on the British Isles, you'd have to know about the geography, the history, the religion, immigration and migration, literature. So deep understanding is often when the different subjects come together and interplay. Does that make sense?
It makes complete sense, actually. It really does. The fact, as you say, it's about the intertwining of subjects and actually children beginning to see those connections here, there and everywhere, and applying all of that knowledge that they've learned from the subjects into something they are utterly passionate about, actually.
Yes, and what we found was because they had chosen the subject, they'd planned it, this was their area of expertise. We got children doing things like mini presentations to the rest of the class about what they were looking at. And that would be so much easier now because then we didn't really have computers, and screens to project on, etc. So I think it's great to do the knowledge-rich curriculum with subjects, but there should be opportunities for the children to do independent study and bring together those subjects, which has not really got much to do with talk for reading, but I think it was worth pointing out.
As I said at the beginning, I always walk away from our sort of conversations just equipped with more and more knowledge. And actually, you always make me think. And it's like, yeah, you know, I taught a child a couple of years ago, actually, who was obsessed, quite literally, with ants. Yep. You know, that's all he wanted to do. He wanted to learn about ants, read about ants, write about ants. Wasn't interested in anything else but ants. And actually, the amount of work that he did on ants, I learned a lot about ants at that point, I'll be honest. The amount of work he did was phenomenal. And it did exactly what you said. It brought together all of these subjects because of his love of ants.
Yeah, and there is, I mean, all of us know we write best and we probably read best about things that we are interested in, things that really, really matter to us. And I think if we don't use or provide opportunities for that, then we're missing a trick. The problem years ago was, if you go back to the 70s, that's in some schools, that's all you ever did. So you never learned anything. You were just sort of tinkering around without knowing anything. So you hadn't got any knowledge to bring together. No. So anyway, we've had another good chat, haven't we?
Oh, I love chatting to you. I really do. Absolutely phenomenal. I always learn so much, and I'm just so pleased that we got another little chat out of it. So, you know, I'm going to ask you this question, because just in case anyone didn't hear our first recording, but do go and listen to that, everyone. But my final question is always the same. If you could have been taught by anyone, living or dead, who would have been your perfect teacher? You may have forgotten what you said last time, so I'm just interested to what today's answer is.
Who would have been the perfect teacher?
Yeah,
I'd love to have been taught by a philosopher, by Socrates. Ooh. Or Plato, who? a big thinker. Well, either Socrates or Plato, I think. But a big thinker, because, yeah, and somebody who enabled me to think deeply. And one of the things I wish, if I'd had any say in the national curriculum, but, you know, nobody did really, other than the minister and a few of his cronies. But if I had had any input, one of the inputs would have been, I think children should do philosophy for children, should be developed as deep thinkers about things. Mm. And philosophy for children, when it's done well, is very, very powerful. We need children from all backgrounds who are capable of deep moral thought, who can think logically about issues in life. And that's an aspect which you hope comes through curriculum teaching. But if you had philosophy for children in a school, you would know that that was being developed. I know what kids are like. They love it. They love having a chat about things. You know, questions like, can ugly things be beautiful? And having a really good discussion about tricky questions like that. I don't know what I said last time.
No, but I'm loving your answer this time. I think your answer last time would have been amazing. But Socrates and Plato absolutely can join the Tiny Voice Taught School. I'm all for them.
Yeah.
Pi, it has been a delight. It really has, chatting again to you. And, you know, I've actually written, whilst talking, 3 pages of notes on Taught for Reading. And for anyone listening that, you know, wants to get hold of it, wants to learn more, I will, on the blurb that's attached to the podcast are all the links and so on. So just have a little look at them. Thank you so much, Pi, for your time. And I really look forward to our next chat.
So do I. And thank you so much for providing the opportunity for so many teachers to come together and to be able to feel welcomed as part of our great profession, welcomed and indeed comforted by these sorts of discussions, where we come together as enthusiasts to focus on what we all so passionately believe in, making a difference for the lives of children. So thank you for all you're doing. And everybody, take care of yourselves, for goodness sake.